Hello and welcome to Seeing Red, a true crime podcast. I'm Mark.
And I'm Bethan. Thank you so much for joining us once again, guys. Did you almost forget that this is a podcast, Mark?
I mean, it's essentially Sunday night because it's a bank holiday Monday, so I've got Sunday vibes and I've switched off. I'm completely switched off, so I don't know even what my own name is.
Fair enough. Just sit back and listen to the episode then.
I will. And I've got a large glass of wine because we're recording of an evening.
I'm very excited. I've got a glass of wine waiting for me when we finish. Can't wait. So a huge thank you this week to listener and friend of the show, William Lamacca, for the suggestion for this week's episode. Huge thank you. And before we begin, we would like to thank our most recent Patreon supporters. Do you want to do the honours, Mark?
I would love to, yeah. We have Roz Barnwell, Sarah, Hope Stern, Danielle Oldham, Zach Tout, Samantha Cronin, Laura and Bear, Kim, Raina Durham, Trisha Donovan, and yeah, that's and all of our existing supporters as well. So a huge thank you to all of you, particularly our new supporters. If you would like to join this crowd, all you need to do is head over to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast and we'll see you there.
And if you want to know more about Patreon, keep listening at the end of the episode. We're going to tell you a little bit more about it. We begin our episode in June 2006, on the 12th of June 2006 to be exact, and we head to Reno in Nevada. Now, I could have done my usual digging into the geography of the area, told you about how it's a city in the northwest section of Nevada, gone into detail about the landscape of the city, and it's known as the biggest little city in the world. But to be honest, the extent of my knowledge of Reno is that Johnny Cash shot a man in Reno in a song. That's okay. Literally all I knew.
I've heard of it.
So instead, you've heard of it, that's something.
I've heard of Reno, but I wouldn't have known where it was. And I'm very ill-informed still because you couldn't be bothered to talk about the landscape, etc.
You're going to stay ill-informed from a geography sort of point of view, but I've got a couple of facts that I wanted to bring you about Reno and Nevada. And they do tie in with this week's case. And I just thought they were a little bit more interesting than me telling you what their native tree is or something like that. In the early 20th century, when most states in the US had highly restrictive laws surrounding divorce, Nevada was the first state to completely relax their laws. So legislation passed in 1931 completed the reduction of the residency requirement from 6 months to 6 weeks. So you didn't have to be a resident for very long to be able to have your divorce in Reno. So quickly, they kind of advertised themselves as the divorce capital of the world. The laws in Nevada at this point were basically very progressive for their time. So they allowed people to put forward numerous grounds for divorce. People only had to be, like I said, living in the area for 6 weeks before they could request the divorce. And the courts in Reno were known for handling cases in a way that was described as sensitively, which I thought was quite fair.
It's kind of good to hear because certainly in the early 20th century, it was really difficult to get a divorce and it was regarded as a bit of a sin, I guess. So yeah, it's nice that people had somewhere to go. And I guess Reno made a whole industry out of this because you're going to have people coming into the city to stay for at least 6 weeks just so they can do this. So there's going to be hotels and B&Bs and all the kind of leisure things that go with that too.
Yeah, exactly. And people did have to swear under oath that they had made Nevada their home. You know, they were definitely residents. They definitely stay there, of course. But yeah, they didn't. And interestingly, the majority of those who came to Reno for divorces were women because Nevada didn't require both parties in a divorce case to be there in the court. Men in general couldn't take that long off work, whereas women didn't tend to work, especially if a woman was married, she probably wouldn't have worked anyway. So it was just a load of women. Can you imagine how much fun these women must have been having? Just rocking up with their bit of paper, ready to divorce their husband, and they just got to hang out there for 6 weeks in the sunshine.
With loads of like-minded women who are going through the same thing and probably desperate for a good time. So I'm kind of thinking that industry may have expanded to what would have probably been known as gigolos back in the 30s, 40s.
Oh, I didn't even think of that, but probably... Yeah, I hope these ladies have had a good time in that aspect as well.
Yeah, too right.
So from the 1930s through to the 1960s, Reno became synonymous with speedy divorce, often referred to colloquially as the six-week cure. And people who headed there for their six-week waiting period were, like you said, Mark, an absolutely brilliant resource for local tourism. Boarding houses, hotels, the numerous restaurants in the city, these were all very busy, bustling places. The divorce businesses kind of eventually died out during the 1970s because other states began to relax their laws, and there was the widespread introduction of no-fault divorce. So rather than having to bring reasons, you could just both say you both want to be out of that, and that was then kind of brought in. So it kind of stopped kind of being this one place that you would go. But something else that happened around the time of divorce legislation being relaxed in Nevada, which was obviously a big draw, another thing that happened at the same time was the legalization of open gambling. So that also happened in 1931. No other state offered legalized casino gaming like Nevada had in the 1930s. So not only have you got these women coming for their quick divorces, probably on their own, they're also then able to go and spend time in casinos. You've got all these men that are able to go and spend time in casinos. I just feel like the whole place must have just been wild and buzzing.
And I guess it would have got that reputation amongst men as well, for this is a place where lots of women are congregating and, to be honest, possibly quite vulnerable, maybe looking for a good time, maybe they're going to have a divorce settlement. So yeah, interesting, they could have been targeted.
Oh, I forgot about the settlements as well.
Yeah,
potentially
could have gone up in smoke in the casinos, or maybe had disreputable men after their money there.
Within a few years, one of the local casinos called the Bank Club, it was actually the largest casino in the world. And as the divorce industry declined, gambling became the major Reno industry. Until the 1960s, Reno was the gambling capital of the United States. So I think nowadays we think of Las Vegas, but for a long time, it really was Reno that was like that capital gambling city in the US. So none of this has anything to do with this case, really. But this case is, it has money, it has divorce, so it kind of links a little bit. So we'll pick up the story on the 12th of June, 2006. And the people of Reno were being warned to stay in their homes because a gunman was on the loose. Family court judge Chuck Weller had been shot in broad daylight and the television channels covered little else. So it was just after 11 o'clock that morning that locals in downtown Reno had heard a loud bang echo off the buildings. Luckily, Judge Weller was alive, but he was badly injured, and he and his assistant were rushed to hospital. His assistant had kind of been covered in shrapnel and shattered glass, kind of from this bullet coming through, and the window that had been shot through was just missing. It was really, really shocking. The police shut down the city, and SWAT teams searched for what they believed was a sniper on the loose. Who knew how many more bullets could be fired? Locals huddled inside downtown businesses, terrified, listening to the noise of helicopters searching above. And the motive was a mystery for detectives. As the forensic teams investigated, they realised that there had only been one bullet fired, and it had hit Judge Weller. And when it exploded through the window of his office, it had sprayed both him and his assistant, like I said, with shrapnel. But he hadn't been killed. The gunman could have taken another shot, potentially, and actually killed him, but he hadn't been. So why had this judge in particular been targeted? Was anyone else in the city in danger? People were just absolutely terrified. Nobody really knew what was going on. They were just glued to their tellies and they were waiting for news. It was just minutes after the shooting that police then received a really worrying phone call from a different point of view. A man called Dan Osborne had been at the home of his friend Darren Mack, and Darren's ex-wife Sharla had been dropping off their daughter Erica. And when Darren and Sharla went into the garage to speak, Dan had been sat chatting with Erica. Erica heard a dog yelp, and she told Dan she thought it was his dog and she thought she could hear something weird. So Dan went to go check on the dog. As he came across Darren coming out of the garage, he said things felt weird. Dan said that Darren brushed past him with a weird look, his hand was wrapped in a towel, and that he didn't say a word. And then next his dog came in and he noticed the dog had blood all over it. When Dan questioned Darren, he fled. So Dan put Erica into his car and he drove away from her dad's house and phoned 911 as he did. On the drive, Darren rang and told Dan to meet him at a local Starbucks. So Dan did what he said, but he was kind of telling the police what was going on. And he said that Darren then spoke to Erica alone and then fled again alone. So based on what they were being told, the police rushed to Darren's home and they immediately found three blood drops outside the garage. They opened the garage door and inside they found Sharla's lifeless body. She had been stabbed multiple times. So of course, Darren Mack was their absolute prime suspect because Dan said he's been acting weird and she'd come to do like a drop off of their daughter. So like they would kind of just, rather than having lots of contact, she'd kind of drive into the garage or park up and walk through into the garage and then they'd drop off or pick up from each other's home. The search of the home by the police actually then turned up even more incriminating evidence, which linked Mack not only to Sharla's murder, but also to this huge manhunt that was ongoing within the city. So Mack had written a note, which police believed to be almost like a step-by-step guide for the day's events. And if it wasn't to do with murder, it would actually be quite laughable because everybody writes to-do lists. Everybody writes themselves little notes of what they need to get on with in the day. But really, when you're planning a day of violence, you're going to write yourself a little note.
And could you have not committed it to memory? This is obviously something awful, but something clearly important to Darren, and you would just know what you need to do and what you're setting out to do. Would you really need to write it down?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the media dubbed this Darren's to-do list, and one of the notes on the list read end problem, and another said parking garage if yes.
Makes about as much sense as my own to-do lists.
It will make more sense as we go on. Police also found a rental contract for a silver Ford Explorer. So they kind of saw this as like end problem, potentially take out Sharla. And if yes, parking garage. So they looked at the surveillance footage of CCTV cameras near the garage across from Weller's office. And pretty soon they were able to completely link him with that crime as well, because at 10:41 a.m., about 20 minutes before Judge Weller was shot, a silver Ford Explorer was photographed entering the parking garage across from the Justice Centre where his office was. And then that silver Ford Explorer was driven up to the fifth floor, parked up with the rear boot lifted. Judge Weller was shot at about 11:05. And the Ford Explorer's boot was seen on CCTV footage being closed at about 11:05. And then the vehicle left the garage. So they were very, very quickly able to kind of link Darren with both crimes.
Do you reckon he got into the boot of that car and was lay there with a rifle or whatever it was, scoping out Judge Weller?
Wow. Or he at least had it in the boot and then opened up the boot to then lay it across something else. So within hours, news reports were broadcasting that Darren Mack was the prime suspect in the Weller shooting and the murder investigation of his estranged wife, Sharla. Whilst Erica was taken to safety and whilst Judge Weller was being treated for his wounds at a local hospital, a nationwide search was underway. But who was Darren Mack? And what on earth had just led to this dramatic turn of events? Darren Mack was born on January the 31st, 1961. He was born and raised in Reno, Nevada, and he attended university on a baseball scholarship. His family owned Palace Jewelry and Loan, and he actually started helping out there from about the age of 7. He was the oldest son of this really wealthy Reno family, and when his father was killed in a 1986 plane crash, Darren became half owner of the business. So he came from money and he was money. In 1986, he married a woman called Deborah Ashlock. They had a son and daughter together and their marriage lasted until 1991. Their separation was really messy. It was a very messy and bitter one. There was a lot of fighting, but eventually they did actually settle on like a shared custody agreement. So they must have kind of eventually found some sort of relationship that worked for their children. Sharla Samsel was born on the 15th of August 1966 in California. And frustratingly, I've been able to find out loads about Darren, but there's really not much about Sharla recorded. She was an actress and she was known for the 1987 film Heaven and the 1992 film Poison Ivy. There's definitely, I can't remember which film it is, but I remember when I looked at the IMDb, there's like one of them's got a really famous actor in as well. And I've really felt for Sharla when I was researching because she'd come from her roots and her background. She was a really confident woman. She really wanted to be famous. And she'd got her foot in the door a little bit. She'd done a couple of things, which was quite big. But for whatever reason, I mean, there must be so many people who want to be famous and who want to be actors. And there's for every 1,000 people, maybe one of them will get a break. So I feel like it was probably not that she wasn't talented, just that it's a really hard industry, isn't it?
Yeah, especially if she was living in California at the time, maybe in Los Angeles. Yeah, I mean, pretty much everybody is trying to make it into show business in that city. So yeah, it's but it's so sad, isn't it? Because quite often it's the way that we know so much about the perpetrator, so much is reported on them, and that is important and interesting. But when it comes to the victims, so little is known so often, and it's sad.
Yeah, it is. According to one of Sharla's friends, she was mischievous. She loved a good little prank. She was a hard worker. She was stubborn. So I thought those were quite interesting points to make about somebody. And Sharla's mum said she had an extraordinary ability to love and take care of people. She was passionate about the world. When Sharla met Darren in the early summer of 1994, she was conducting a nutritional workshop as a course leader, and they met at a dinner that was held for the seminar, and they very quickly hit it off. They got married in 1995, and for a while at least, the pair and Darren's kids seemed to be one big happy family, a pretty normal family. I mean, mum was an aspiring actress, dad was from a background with money, but still quite, you know, just a regular family. He was described as handsome and charismatic. He had a good body. He even took part in bodybuilding competitions and got as far as finishing fifth one time in Mr. Nevada bodybuilding. And she was described as a pocket rocket, a happy, positive woman, confident and motivated. They were one of those couples, both gorgeous, well-known in the town. They had money. They looked like they were in a really happy marriage. It was, when you say like one of those couples, I think everybody kind of knows what you mean.
Yeah, because you look at people like that from the outside looking in, and you might even know them. They might be friends, and sometimes envy creeps in and you sort of think, wow, they're so in love and they've got a brilliant life, a brilliant lifestyle together, and I want some of that. But actually, so often behind the scenes, it is not as rosy as it looks on the outside. And yeah, it's usually those that put that kind of facade on that have the worst time behind closed doors.
Yeah, and that is exactly the case in this, with their story, because that clean-cut image was what they portrayed on the surface. And from the beginning, everyone who knew the couple would say that they did have this chemistry. This chemistry was undeniable. People had described them as explosive together. That spark was actually quite evident in their sexual lives as well. And within their private lives, they were actually swingers. They became a fixture on the strip club circuit in Reno. They were well known within the swinging community. So there was a little bit of scandal.
Yeah, I'm just looking at your notes. I literally read it as within the shagging community, even though you quite clearly have put swinging community.
I mean,
it's the same difference.
What is it? Tomato, tomato. I was going to say potato, potato, but potato, that's definitely potato. Not the phrase.
Last week fisting, this week swinging.
There we go. This show is going downhill.
It just keeps on giving, yeah.
Keeps on swinging.
Yeah.
When Sharla and Darren's daughter Erica was born in 1997, things began to change. Sharla told Darren that she was no longer interested in swinging. It was also reported that the relationship was chaotic and abusive, so family and friends had witnessed both Sharla and Darren screaming at one another. Sharla had told people she thought Darren would kill her. Darren had kept a journal in which he detailed the abuse he suffered at Sharla's hands. So he reportedly stated that she had kicked him in the testicles, that she'd scratched his car, she'd yelled at him on the phone, she belittled him in front of his friends. And Darren's friend Michael later said that despite his imposing stature, Darren lived in fear. And his friend Michael said, a big part of Darren's desire to end the marriage was this abuse that he said he was suffering at the hands of Sharla. People in their friendship circle were well aware of this, and they knew that Darren carried a gun because he actually worried one day Sharla might try and kill him.
Wow, this is interesting because we don't often see this. So obviously he does go on to kill his wife, but it's interesting that she was abusive towards him. We probably don't know that for definite, but it sounds like she was, and there's people to corroborate that. And from her character description, I can kind of see it. So yeah, it does. At this point, it sounds like not that she deserved to be killed by Darren, but that he was living perhaps in fear of her abuse.
Yeah. And I think especially for this to be quite publicly known about in this time as well.
And if she's belittling him in front of friends, for example, then it's pretty obvious, you know, they're going to see that. Mm-hmm. And he might have confided in friends and said, yeah, you know, she's crazy and she's done this to me and she's done that to me. So I don't disbelieve him.
No, I definitely don't. But what I would say is don't forget that there is also abuse the other way as well. As, you know, Sharla's friends said that she was looking over her shoulder all the time too. One of Sharla's friends later described an altercation where Darren had Sharla by the neck and was trying to strangle her. So I don't think this was a very clear-cut case of one party abusing the other. I think they were both so volatile, so dramatic and fiery, and this explosive chemistry, well, that's great when it's just shagging and having a great old time, Bethan, but when you've then also
so
got
uncouth.
Life and family, but do you know what I mean? Well and good at the beginning, but then when you've got a family life and you're still having these very, very fired up arguments, and actually then when it turns violent as well, it sounded as though they were both, I don't know, like as bad as each other, really. They were both giving as good as they got.
Yeah, they do sound, I mean, this sounds like a toxic marriage. It's volatile, that is so the word to use. And I'm assuming here, but Darren could have been taking steroids. If he was into bodybuilding, particularly at that time, then he could have been taking steroids, and there can be side effects from that in terms of aggressiveness and anger, just an altered personality. So that may have not helped if he was. We don't know that for certain, but I bet he was. So, yeah, it's just a toxic, volatile marriage.
And in the end, it was Sharla who filed for divorce in February 2005, and Darren moved out. Darren moved out into a condo, and Sharla and the kids stayed at the family home. It's not unusual, is it, for a breakdown of a relationship to turn sour? Many of us have been through a divorce or know a couple who have, and it is very sadly the exception instead of the rule for the process to be civil. It's far more likely that arguments and anger will rule.
Yeah, because you're bringing emotions into it, there's dependence, you're bringing money into it. All these emotive subjects are being fought over and disputed, and not always, like you say, there are exceptions.
In a very black and white way, though.
Yeah, and in a cold, calculated way. So, yeah, it's
with strangers pouring over your every move and your bank accounts.
Yeah,
and
you're
life.
Paying money out for that. It's just, I mean, I've never been through it, fortunately, but I imagine it is absolutely up there with bereavement and some of those other, you know, huge life events that happen that just affect you for the rest of your life usually in a bad way. But it can be a good thing, divorce. It can be a good thing if it's a right thing and it's amicable, but like you say, that's so often not the case.
No, and Darren's previous divorce was bitter. Eventually they did find a way of co-parenting. They found a way to do that, and that was great, but it had been a very long, if not, I think it was over a year of a divorce proceedings, that first divorce. And again, here, these divorce proceedings, they were between two people for whom life within a relationship had become abusive at times, and tensions were absolutely running high. It was long and drawn out, it was bitter, and it was a money-fueled court battle. Throughout the bitter separation, Darren and Sharla, of course, faced off against each other in court for this divorce settlement because they weren't able to come to any sort of agreement between themselves, so they had to go to the courts to make that decision for them. And so Judge Weller was who was ruling over their divorce settlements. He ordered Darren to pay Sharla $10,000 a month until the divorce was settled. And Darren thought that the ruling and the judge were unfair. He felt like Weller wasn't listening to him. He felt that Sharla's attorney was lying about everything he was filing. But then he also felt like Weller knew this and was letting the attorney get away with it. Now, to be fair, it wasn't just Darren Mack who wasn't happy with Judge Weller. He wasn't an entirely popular judge. I've read very conflicting things about him. So there's lots of people who are very much on his side and very much think he's wonderful. And then there's plenty of people who make criticisms about him that he would make snap decisions. He didn't like to listen to both sides fairly. He actually had twice as many preemptory challenges as any other family court judge. But I don't think this necessarily meant he made bad decisions. I think he just acted quickly. I think he got a gut feeling and went with it. And there was a lot that Darren Mack did within the court that wouldn't have looked good. So, for example, he still wanted to go out swinging, go into his swingers clubs and groups. And he actually went to a brothel to go and celebrate that he was going to be getting divorced, even though his lawyer said, don't do that because it's going to look really bad. And one of Sharla's things was, I don't want to keep swinging. And he keeps on wanting to go to these clubs. And that's one of the major parts of the breakdown of their relationship. So, as Adam would say, stay classy. He did not. The bitterness of the Max divorce was a long, drawn-out period of time. The courtroom battle went on for over a year and a half, and mostly this was about money. At one point, Weller even threatened to throw Darren in jail because he violated a court order. And Judge Weller had repeatedly asked Darren and Sharla to try and reach some kind of financial agreement on their own because he didn't want to be forced to do this for them. But they didn't. So he made the decision. So the decision was a lump sum of $480,000 for Sharla to buy a house and a car. And then over the next 5 years, she was then supposed to receive that $10,000 a month in spousal support. Darren Mack was shocked. He was appalled at this. He didn't think it was fair that he had to hand over so much of his wealth. But to the judge, it was fair. His gross monthly income was approximately $44,000. His wife had no income. And I did a bit of digging about what he was worth. 2 years previously, so in 2003, his income was reportedly estimated at $500,000 annually, and his net worth was $9.4 million. So the judge has obviously made this decision based off of fact. I don't think the judge has plucked these figures out of thin air. Soon after this ruling, Sharla was dead, Judge Weller was in hospital, and there was no sign of Darren Mack. Judge Weller later described how he lay in a hallway, bleeding, as deputies administered first aid, and he said it was terrible. Investigators matched the ammo from Darren's house to the bullet that was used to shoot Weller in the chest, and on June the 13th, 2006, a warrant was issued for Darren's arrest, charging him with the murder. But as I said earlier, Darren was by this point on the run. Judge Weller was terrified, and he later said of the whole situation and of Darren Mack, he was on the loose, so I was concerned. Normal life stopped. I didn't go to work. I didn't go to the grocery store. I didn't leave my home. And I just really feel for him. Obviously, like I said, there's a lot of people who weren't fans of his, but even if you're not a fan of someone and how they rule their courtroom, You would never wish this. You would never wish this fear on anyone. Cell phone data placed Darren Mack leaving Nevada and heading towards California. Reno investigators were tracking possible sightings as well in Mexico, so they were all over looking for where he could have possibly gone. They swarmed hotels where there were potential sightings. They worked with the FBI. Reporters were also hunting the fugitive in Mexico too, so hoping for that scoop of we found him and then we tipped the police off. Mack was featured on the Fox show America's Most Wanted, and he was also on the FBI's Most Wanted website at this point as well. He was real, on the run, and everybody was looking for him. But amazingly, considering he's like a normal guy, he was actually able to evade the police for 10 days. I say like he's a normal guy. He was a good shot. He had like a gun license, and all of these the guns that he had were registered. I know we kind of talked about it in other cases as well, and I it was quite obvious in all of this, like everything was registered. There was no illegal behaviour around that side of things. And yes, he was very well trained, but otherwise he wasn't, you know, he wasn't some like, he hadn't secretly been a spy. He hadn't been in like the SAS, you know, in his past or anything. So I feel like to be able to evade all of the law enforcement agencies ever,
including the FBI,
including the FBI for 10 days.
That is impressive.
It was pretty amazing. Eventually, Darren Mack did decide to surrender. He tried to bargain with the police about the terms of this surrender, but to very little avail. The police on the 22nd of June found him in a pool in Puerto Vallarta in Mexico. And when they caught him, they found he had $360,000 in cash, 20 credit cards, a pair of shoes that had blood spatter on them, other clothing items that had blood on them. So he'd literally bundled everything up and fled. He didn't get rid of stuff. He just kind of took what he could. But he surrendered to the Mexican authorities and he was flown back to Texas the following day.
I suppose he knew, because I'm thinking, why did he surrender? But I guess he must have known. He must have seen his face everywhere and thought, it's only a matter of time.
Yeah, I think he just knew that the game was up. Judge Weller spent time recovering and he actually returned to his courtroom on the 16th of August, which I thought was very soon, considering this all happened in June.
Yeah, two months later. Yeah.
But I did find it really interesting with Judge Weller. So he kind of took this as almost like a sign that he needed to do more within his capacity as a judge to identify couples that he would see in front of him where there was potential abuse.
Mm.
And he studied domestic violence and court security extensively. He ended up receiving a master's degree in judicial studies, writing about domestic violence, and a doctorate in judicial studies, writing about court security. And he kind of said that he really wanted to understand what had happened and got to that point where Charles is dead, he's been shot, put it into context for him, but then also use that to potentially protect people in the future. And there's a great article that I read where he talks about how he says, maybe if I had known more like I know now, I might have seen different signs and this may not have ended the way it did, which I thought was a lot for him to put on himself, but also quite admirable that he did actually take that step back and look at this and think, well, what can I do differently going forward if I've got a couple in front of me where potentially there are signs that this could be deadly?
I guess he had got to know Sharla quite well up to this point, and clearly Darren had Judge Weller and Sharla on his hit list. He was successful with killing Sharla, less successful with Judge Weller. So Judge Weller must have been thinking, I have really escaped here with my life, and Sharla wasn't so lucky. And it kind of makes sense that he would go back over those events and think, I need something to come out of this, something good, perhaps in the memory of Sharla. And that's absolutely right. That's admirable what he did. And relevant, isn't it? You know, he is a judge and he is dealing with acrimonious divorces and everything that goes with that. And actually, yeah, he probably does have an obligation to see when there is danger there and do something about it.
Yeah, because he could have put some sort of protection in place to ensure that the two parties didn't have to have proper contact, for example, or even
a restraining order.
Restraining orders or something, yeah. You know. Or maybe make those decisions sooner and make it more clear cut straight away so that it doesn't get as heated and twisted and bitter as it then would be a year and a half down the line.
Yeah.
You haven't had that clear split from somebody. You're still entwined.
You're in limbo as well in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe he would have just had a bit more sympathy towards Darren in particular. It sounds like he had that towards Sharla. Although that does sound more fair. It's fine what she had. She could have had more and been entitled to more. But yeah, Darren did perceive that this injustice. And maybe part of that was Judge Weller, I don't know, not taking Darren's side as much as he took Sharla's.
So the trial of Darren Mack, charged with murder and attempted murder, began with a preliminary hearing on August the 30th, 2006. And if you thought this was going to be a simple, clear-cut case, well, of course not. Darren Mack was not going to go down quietly. He pleaded not guilty to the charges at an arraignment in September, and then his trial was set for the 1st of October 2007. So there's loads online that you can find out about the trial, because it quite understandably got a lot of media attention. So they had to move the trial to Las Vegas. It was too well known in Nevada to get a fair jury. And finally, on the 5th of November 2007, things kind of started properly. Mack's legal team brought forward a guilty plea to first-degree murder and then entered an Alford plea to the attempted murder charge just as the trial was to begin, in exchange for a recommendation by the prosecutor for life in prison with parole available after 20 years. So they wanted to take this plea and this bargain. In criminal law, I feel like we've talked about this in a case before, and I cannot remember for definite which case it was, but the Alford plea is a type of guilty plea in which the defendant does not admit to committing the crime, but agrees that the prosecution has enough evidence to obtain a conviction. So they're kind of saying, I did not do this, but you're going to find me guilty because I get it. The information you've got and the evidence you've got. Was it O.J. Simpson?
It may have been. We've definitely covered that before.
We've definitely talked about an Alford plea, haven't we?
I couldn't remember what it was called, but we've talked about that arrangement, and it kind of makes sense. It's almost like a bargaining between the court and the defendant, and it sort of does make sense.
But it's not saying you're guilty, which is really frustrating because you're not actually admitting what you did.
Yeah, it's. I mean, really, if you are guilty, if you're not guilty, then it's an absolute travesty because you're having to bargain with the court and accept a sentence, in this case, potentially of 20 years, and you've done nothing wrong. Although, of course, Darren had in this case, clearly. But yeah, it's a weird concept.
And actually, Mack said during this plea, I do understand right now in my state of mind that shooting at the judiciary is not a proper form of political redress. You don't say. I loved it. It just made me chuckle so much. Like, oh, shouldn't have shot the judge because
shit.
I wasn't happy.
Yeah,
no shit, Sherlock. Darren's attorneys planned quite a unique defence strategy, but one that you can understand why they would bring this as their defence. So self-defence in the murder of Sharla, and then insanity for the attempted murder of Judge Tuckweller. So they stated that Sharla had attacked Darren, he had acted in self-defence when he killed her, and he had then been in an overly distressed state and had not been in his right mind when he headed off to shoot the judge. You can kind of see where that would make sense. And actually, after, I know we're going to reference him quite a lot now because he's really got into my head, but Dr. Das's book really made me think in this case, if that was true, that does make sense that you're then in a completely different mindset to a normal mindset for this person. But also he wrote what looks like a to-do list. So it doesn't sound,
Yeah, it's such an interesting book, though. It's called In Two Minds by Dr. Shaham Das. I know we've talked about it a couple of times, but yeah, I would absolutely recommend that. It's really, really interesting. He's a forensic psychiatrist.
And a really funny book as well. We both really quite enjoyed that, didn't we?
We did.
But anyway, sorry, I digress. Later in the court proceedings, Darren Mack attempted to withdraw his pleas. So he said he was coerced by his legal team and that his signature was forged. And I have seen a couple of people online have done side-by-side comparisons of sample signatures of Darren Mack's, and the one on the plea does look different.
Yeah, but I mean, I just think his hand could have been shaken because it's quite an important document.
Well, no, they look very different.
Really different, though?
Yeah, like a different signature.
Right, okay.
Rather than the same signature, but differently.
Yeah.
However, what if one signature was when he was younger and he changed his signature? What if he signed it slightly differently because of his state of mind? Or on purpose, yeah, you don't know. But that was he kind of said this. And he actually did fire those previous lawyers, but he was completely unsuccessful in his attempt to get a new trial. He continued to state he was not insane at any point. And again, with now thinking about mad or bad, whether or not any actual investigation was done into his mental state. I can't see anything really that points to anything being properly investigated, but he was adamant that he was absolutely not insane at any point.
So he'd have been better off saying that he was, but like you say, a criminal psychiatrist would have uncovered the truth, but he'd have been better off being mad rather than bad in terms of sentencing.
And the bit that I don't get with Darren Mack is that we will go on in a bit more detail about what he claimed happened that day. But when it comes to Judge Weller, he doesn't really give any sort of defence or even reasons. And I know you don't have to. You don't have to at all. But I just don't... If he could kind of give something as to why he went and did that, it might make more sense to me. I don't know. To me, the whole thing feels premeditated.
Yeah, totally. However, yeah. Judge Weller survived his attempted murder. So it's kind of easy to just disregard that and not say anything about it and not have any sort of mitigation because, well, I didn't kill him. I injured him, but I didn't kill him. So yeah, do what you want. Find me guilty of that. You could call it attempted murder, call it whatever you want, but I didn't murder him, so I'm not going to go down for long for that. So that's why he's not bothered about that.
And that's kind of how it feels with the court as well. The court doesn't seem to have... It's attempted murder. He's fine. He's already carrying on overseeing his court. Like, he's been back at work for a year.
Yeah, and that would have all kind of factored into it of... Yeah, I mean, it is attempted murder. However... How badly injured was this guy if he's able to go back to work 2 months later? It's still pretty bad, but people get beaten up and they can't go back to work for 3 months. So, and that's not regarded as attempted murder.
No, and you're absolutely right that side of things is just brushed aside. Whereas Sharla, of course, you know, this is a woman who has been murdered. So her part of the trial was absolutely what everyone focused on. Darren's son and his mum testified during the trial at points, which was really apparently very moving. Some of the courtroom were in tears listening to them talking about what had happened. And on cross-examination, Darren Mack then did admit to killing his wife and shooting Judge Chuck Weller. But he claimed it was self-defence when he killed Sharla. So on direct examination by his new attorney, Mac described a fight with Sharla that had ended in her death. So according to Darren, it was very acrimonious, obviously, this whole divorce, everything going on. He'd just been told that he had to pay all this money. So she was dropping off their daughter and they were doing handovers that were not where they were chatting to each other. It wasn't come in for a cup of tea or anything. It was literally drive up.
Oh my God, I just feel so much for Erica. As well in that scenario, because obviously I don't know how old she was at this point, but less than 10, I guess, based on when this happened and when she was born, when they got married in 94, 95.
Erica was born in 97 and then this is 2006. So
so she's 8 or 9. She is a little girl who is not worldly wise and her parents hate each other and she is being treated like fucking cargo, sort of dropped and they're not having any sort of exchange. Obviously it gets a hell of a lot worse for her because her mum fucking dies and her dad goes to prison. But even before all of this happened, can you imagine the life she was living, being dropped between these two homes and all this?
Makes you so sad, doesn't it?
Yeah, incredibly sad.
And also that from what I've read, Darren's children from his previous marriage and Erica, they all kind of grew up. Obviously, his other children were older. They were teenagers by this point. But, you know, she's got these other siblings as well. And the whole family dynamic just sounds really, really rubbish and difficult.
Mm.
And yeah, I was the same as you. I just felt so sorry for this little girl in the middle of it all, being kind of put in a car and driven here, there and everywhere by different people, going on.
And just sort of unloaded without any sort of, you know, warm handover or exchange. And she would have felt the tension and the hate that her parents had towards each other. And I know, I mean, I'm really fortunate, we both are, that our parents are still together and we didn't have to go through the trauma of parents divorcing in our own childhood. But I know lots of children do, and I know that will resonate with so many people listening to this right now.
And the idea of her, when she sat there talking to Dan, Darren's friend, and I really wanted to know more about what did Darren say to her when she's in this parking lot of Starbucks and he speaks to her privately and then off he goes again. And she's just this child, like, I will go on to talk about a little bit more about her, but I didn't want to do too much research into her. I felt like she needs privacy and I hope that she still has that. I just didn't feel like she needed to be searched and researched and Googled.
Unless she wants to be out there, then why? Yeah, she's in her late 20s now, living, hopefully, her own life and some way moving forward from all of this. But yeah, it's right to not delve into that.
So according to Darren, their argument escalated. And when he turned his back on Sharla, he says that Sharla knocked him to the ground. Some reports say that she punched him in the back of the head and knocked him to the ground or shoved him in the back. But basically, he fell to the ground and he says that the gun he was carrying fell out of his pocket. Sharla went to hit Darren again and then Darren pushed her. She stumbled, she fell on the gun. So then he says that after all this scuffling and this fighting, she picked up the gun and aimed it right at him. And he said he told her, "Sharla, give me the gun, it's loaded." But Sharla looked at the gun, smiled, and then fired directly at him. Darren says the gun misfired. Sharla tried to pull the trigger again, but at this point he'd grabbed a knife and was defending himself.
This is bullshit, isn't it?
Well, this is what he says. He was carrying a gun. That is definitely true. He was known to carry a gun. He had said to people that he, to his friends, he carried a gun because he felt like she would kill him at some point. So I don't know if we can fully say it didn't happen. And the fact that the gun misfired, if this part of the story is true, might explain why police found no evidence of a gun being involved in the crime. They obviously turned up and kind of found her being stabbed and there wasn't a gunshot residue or a bullet or something like that.
Because I'm thinking, when you say misfire, I'm thinking, oh, it's gone off on its own by accident. So there would be a bullet somewhere. But yeah, so it's just malfunctioned, potentially.
Yeah, she's tried to fire it at him, but it's clicked instead of firing.
Yeah, so that, yeah, okay, fair enough. That could have absolutely happened, yeah.
Yeah. It was the first time that the prosecution team had actually heard anything about a gun in the garage, though, which does start to lead away from that. Darren asked his legal team to look for the gun to support his claims, but they refused to do so, apparently, according to Darren. There's quite a lot with him and his claims that I find really hard to follow. So many people who worked with him or for him at the trial or throughout the trial described him as hard work. He wanted to do everything himself. He wanted to be involved in everything. So maybe his legal team did choose to ignore this element. Maybe he suddenly sprung it on them and it was too late.
It could have been one of 100 demands. You know, this is a guy who is demanding. And my God, don't we all know somebody like this? Not quite as extreme with this example. But yeah, you're just like, fucking hell, just shut up and let me do my job. So
yeah,
I understand.
I am the lawyer.
Yeah.
Let me do it.
Yeah,
you're paying me
a lot of money to do
exactly.
It. Stop trying to direct exactly what's happening here. You don't know what you're doing.
The defensive wounds on Sharla had told a certain story to investigators. They described the 7 stab wounds that Darren had inflicted upon her, as well as other defensive wounds, showed that she had been attacked and she'd attempted to protect herself against an attack. And surely a gun would have been found by police if they'd been searching the garage for evidence, because according to Darren, he hadn't then picked it up and gone. He hadn't taken it when he fled. So to him, that gun should have been in the garage.
Yeah.
And sure, I mean, this is the thing. Sometimes police investigations are shoddy. Sometimes they see one answer, they go with that because it fits their narrative. But I feel like you'd be combing that garage for clues and a gun discarded on the floor surely would have been found.
If they're looking for things like gun residue, for example, which is microscopic traces of, I don't know, like gun stuff, then they're forensically analysing that crime scene, which
but
they would have
they?
Done.
Did
well,
they
I'm
just
sure
look
they
at,
would
did
have
Did they
done.
Just look at stab wounds, though, and go, she's been stabbed, we don't need to go any further?
Yeah, but
that's what Darren says.
Yeah, you can't rule it out, can you? You can't
you
rule
can't.
It out 100%.
But I just...
This is infuriating, Bethan. This is infuriating.
I know it is, isn't it? But this is the thing with this entire trial, is it's here, there and everywhere. Higgledy-piggledy. He comes up with these things and... But anyway, it was clear, you know, he had killed her. He had shot at the judge. That was not disputed. He admitted this. And I'm sorry to keep labouring this point, but if you step aside from the official reports, from the official trial, this side thing with Sharla provoking Darren, Sharla actually attacking Darren first and him acting in self-defence, his son, Jory, was a teen at the time of his stepmom's murder. He really believes his father's side of things. He's done an interview where he's spoken about his dad not receiving a fair trial. He says he was attacked by Sharla first. He reacted. He was simply defending himself.
And yeah, it could be. It could be.
And something that Jory mentioned, or like the interviewer Jory mentioned, is that Darren Mack was a well-trained marksman. He knew what he was doing with guns. If he'd wanted to kill the judge, he would have been able to. Maybe he would have taken another shot. So his son kind of says, well, he clearly didn't want to actually kill him. He chose not to. It's kind of just an aside, but I thought it was interesting.
I want to just bitch slap Darren for this, because it's just mind-bendingly frustrating that I part of me can't not believe some of what he's saying or not cast out on this. You know, I do kind of lean towards maybe there's an element of truth in what he is saying, and that is really frustrating for me, because yeah, on the face of it, I absolutely think he set out to murder Sharla and he did that. I think he probably did set out to murder Judge Weller before that. I think it was before, wasn't it? And just fucked it up a bit. Even if he is a brilliant marksman, he can still make mistakes. If the gun had misfired later on, then it could have misfired then. Who knows?
And my thing with this is, she's pulled a gun on you and you've stabbed her to death. Ring the police.
Mm.
Say that, you know, this has just happened. I've just defended myself against a crazy ex-wife that shot me.
How many times have we seen this where we're like, if, you know, when someone's not necessarily murdered someone, but they're involved in someone's murder, and you just
and
sort
then
of think,
they just cover yeah, it up.
And they just cover yeah. it up. They get in really deep and they end up with a 20-year prison sentence themselves, when actually they didn't do an awful lot. And they should have, with hindsight, absolutely just gone to the police and said, this has happened, I fucked up. You know, I'll squeal all the information, and they'd probably have not even gone to prison. So I think in that irrational moment, you're just incapable of making proper decisions.
Yeah. And then this is where that insanity plea from his original team could make a lot of sense. If this was true, if she had tried to kill him and I just feel like that gun would have been found at some point.
Yeah.
That garage would have been combed over, surely. Before Darren was sentenced, both families had a chance to speak. Darren's son tried really desperately to convince the judge that there was another side to his dad, which was really emotional. And I believe that was Jory, who's still very outspoken on his dad's support. Sharla's family had their turn. The whole thing was very emotional. And then finally, it was Darren Mack's turn. It's not unusual for a defendant to say a few words of apology at a sentencing hearing, but the length of Mack's statements was highly unusual. For 3 hours, he tried to convince the judge that he had absolutely acted in self-defence. He repeated how, I wouldn't enter a guilty plea on murder one because I didn't murder Sharla. And at no point throughout the course of the entire trial, or his three-hour lecture, Darren never said what many people hoped to hear, that he was sorry about her death. He was sorry about the shooting of the judge.
I'm sorry about the circumstances that led to her death. There's ways of wording it that still renounce you of culpability.
These 3 hours was him, all about him. And I guess that's probably why there's very little sympathy towards Mac. He comes across as a man who couldn't bear the thought of giving his ex-wife so much money, couldn't be seen to lose, and he just spoke about himself.
He's a narcissist, isn't he?
Yeah. And actually, you know, if he was being abused by his wife and he was pushed to this point, that is awful. I feel like if that was the case, I don't know, like, I feel like surely something else would have come up in the trial, but instead he's still just talking about himself all the time. It just doesn't lend well to the fact that he was in any way innocent of anything. He just proves everyone right that think he's done this.
And he clearly is a narcissist, and I don't think a narcissist would take this plea deal of 20 years. I think a narcissist would absolutely want their opportunity to present their defence and to say, I absolutely did not do this and I'm going to convince you all why. And he didn't have the opportunity to do that because he said, well, I'm not going to plead guilty to the murder of Sharla, but I'm not going to sort of dispute it. So we'll kind of do this bargain.
He didn't want to. So his team agreed that at first and he went back on that and said that they had coerced him, that they'd forged his signature,
that he didn't agree to it.
And so that does fit your narcissistic side of things then, that actually he wanted his time in court to tell everyone his sad, sad sort of story.
And I think they've got the measure of him. They've got the measure of him and were like, you know, this is the only way we're going to get
because they need to try and have a win.
Yeah, and this is some kind of win. This is a win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then he fires them all and says, I don't want to do what they told me.
Yeah, narcissistic behaviour.
And, you know, if Sharla did pull a gun on him and it was all spur of the moment, what was that list all about? End the problem and if yes, go to the parking garage.
And he hired that car. I mean, he was clearly setting out to murder Judge Weller, whatever his name was. He just fucked that up, I think.
I think so too. So anyway, back to the case. On the 6th of February 2008, the judge sentenced Mac to life in prison for murdering his wife. And he also gave Mac the maximum sentence of 40 years with parole eligibility after 16 years for the attempted murder of Judge Weller. You did get his name right. And for a deadly weapon enhancement, which I believe related to the fact that he'd made his normal rifle a kind of sniper rifle. So the sentences were to run consecutively, so he was ineligible for parole for at least 36 years. And on the sentencing, Sharla's mum said it brought her a sense of peace. So on the 18th of March 2008, a county jury delivered a $590 million settlement against Mac in the wrongful death lawsuit of Sharla. So $560 million was awarded to Erica, and the remainder had to go to his wife's estate.
I never understand this, though, because where's this money coming from? None of that money will have made its way to Erica.
I don't know, because he was worth money.
Yeah, but not $560 million.
No. But then anything that his businesses make while he's in prison, for example.
And at least all that wealth he had acquired up to this point, at least that is going to go to his daughter.
It's going to go to Erica.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the judge addressed the grandmothers of, by then, 10-year-old Erica. She was kind of like the sole survivor of this awful, awful mess. And he said to them, hopefully you don't raise an angry and spiteful child who doesn't know who in her family to trust. She needs to be raised with hugs and kisses and not talking bad about each of those people. A child without her mother and her father for a great number of years is going to need a lot of love from both sides of the aisle. And a custody agreement was met. Sharla's mum was granted primary custody, but Darren's mum actually would share Erica on an alternating weekly schedule. And Darren Mac was going to have to pay $1,500 per month in child support whilst in prison. And I thought, you know what, how wonderful that this child was really thought about, was cared for. The judge was keen to ensure that she actually was given the best possible life. And to really say those quite stern things to her grandmothers, I just really liked that. As good of a childhood as she possibly could, you know, that she had those two grandmothers and her family supporting her. Like I said, I didn't want to Google her. I don't want to know where she is now. I don't want to know, like, to try and find out, because, you know, from a nosy point of view, I do. But actually, I want her to just have her privacy and not be searched. And then, obviously, Judge Weller continued to work on as a judge for years. I think for about seven, how many years afterwards? I remember reading it somewhere. He did retire, but he retired not, you know, quite often you'd find that someone would retire because they've been shot, but
so many years
at
after
least
this,
like 15
yeah.
years later, yeah, he was then a judge, so that was quite nice.
Yeah, and probably quite a different one for the last chapter in his career based on what had
it
happened.
Sounds like it, from the fact that he then really wanted to know more about domestic abuse and how he could potentially protect people that he saw within his courtroom.
Yeah,
I think he did change his style a little bit.
Mm.
So there we go. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Don't go anywhere, though, because...
Oh, crikey, Mark. That was assertive.
We wanted to talk about Patreon, didn't we?
Yes. Before you go, we wanted to take a few minutes of your time today and talk to you about Patreon, because you guys hear us talking about it in every show when we thank our newest supporters, but... what exactly is Patreon? So Patreon is an exclusive platform that allows fans to pay their favourite creators a monthly amount in exchange for exclusive access and extra content.
And we have so much to offer you there. When you sign up to our most popular tier, which is £3.50 a month, you get access to...
full-length bonus episodes of Seeing Red and a back catalogue of the other ones that we have done as well. So you don't just get them from the point
episodes,
you sign up.
Absolutely.
40 plus.
You get access to our brand new... Well, I say brand new. It is not brand new anymore. But our 18-month-old Patreon-exclusive podcast, Crime Wave, in which we discuss topical true crime stories making the news. There's got to be 40 plus episodes of that. We release an episode every 2 weeks and have done since January 2023.
Gosh, we've been doing that for ages.
We have.
I do enjoy Crime Wave as well.
Fucking love Crime Wave, yeah.
You get access to our True Crime Book Club.
Access to competitions and giveaways, which we've just done. We had 8 phenomenal prizes we have just given away. They have been posted now.
And behind the scenes stuff like occasional blog posts and videos. I did a little mini episode with Bella recently, which people enjoyed. So she's got some questions to answer in the next instalment. And you get ad and sponsor free episodes of Seeing Red.
And as well as all of that, by signing up to support us on Patreon, you are really supporting us and the show, ensuring we're around for a long time, not just a good time. And it means that I've been able to drop some hours at work, which means that we can devote more time to the show and produce longer episodes like this one. This is kind of normal for us to do more than an hour now, because we have the time, and that support from you through Patreon is what has allowed that to happen. So we are so grateful.
There is no minimum commitment. And there are also different ways that you can sign up as well. So you can do, we've definitely had people do annual subscriptions themselves, but a couple of people have had like a gift, like a birthday present or something, which I think is always really fun. And there's different tiers as well. So there's different levels of support. And all of the bonus content can then be streamed through the Patreon app. So you can listen anytime, any place. Most podcast providers also allow you to stream the bonus content through their platform. So you could then also listen to it in the way that you listen to our weekly episodes as well. That's what I've done for other shows that I've been Patreon supporters of. Just use my own private RSS code and then listen through my app.
And if you don't know what an RSS code or an RSS feed is, it doesn't matter. You don't really need to know. It's so
they kind of teach
quick.
You, don't they? Because
yeah.
I didn't until it told
I didn't.
Me what to do.
It's so quick and simple to set it up so that, yeah, you can listen to all of our episodes of Seeing Red, but then all of the bonus content in exactly the same way you listen to us now. It takes just 2 minutes to sign up to Patreon. And when you do, you'll find that you've opened yourself up to a whole new world of Seeing Red.
So please, if you would like to, head to patreon.com/seeingredpodcast, or you can just Google Seeing Red Podcast Patreon. And don't forget to put www. At the beginning.
Whatevs, even if you're Googling
it. You forgot
it.
That. You
Whatever.
Missed that, Mark. www.google.co.uk.
No, that's bollocks.
Seeing Red Podcast Patreon.
Okay. Thank you for listening, everybody. That was a super interesting case, Bethan.
Thank you.
But also
thank
frustrating.
Thank you, William, for recommending it.
Yeah, thank you, William. And if you have recommendations for us, please do get in touch in all the usual ways. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and you can email us as well. You can get our email address through our website, and the website's in the show notes. And you can also get all of your merch there too. We'll see you next week for another episode of Seeing Red. So we will see you there.
Bye.
Hi, angels. It's your girl, Louise Rumble, and I'm the host of the Open House podcast. Therapy quite literally changed my life and sent me straight into my hot, healing girl era. Now, each week, I share my story, the good, the bad, and the downright juicy, and chat with some of the world's best therapists, psychologists, and wellness experts. From love, sex, and dating to attachment styles, nervous system regulation, wellness hacks, hormone balancing, and more, nothing is off the table. I've emptied my bank account on therapy and healing so you don't have to. So if you're ready to leave the past in the past and build the future you've always deserved, me and my favorite experts are waiting for you on the Open House podcast. Listen now wherever you stream your podcasts, and I cannot wait to meet you.